Many of the men I have seen have scars on their bodies, and when I made signs to them to find out how this happened, they indicated that people from other nearby islands came to San Salvador to capture them. They defend themselves the best they can. I believe that people from the mainland come here to take them as slaves. They ought to make good and skilled servants, for they repeat very quickly whatever we say to them. I think they can very easily be made Christians, for they seem to have no religion. If it pleases our Lord, I will take 6 of them to your highness when I depart, in order that they may learn our language. In subsequent journal entries, Christopher Columbus describes not only his discoveries of lands unknown to Europeans, but points also toward the subjugation that led to the extinction of various people in the New World, the Arawaks of the Bahamas, for one. As he settled into the New World with its welcoming natives and rumors of gold, did Columbus change his plan to Christianize the people he found there? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
In Columbus's time, how competitive was the search for an ocean route to Asia? What were his aims in looking for that route? Once he reached land, where did he think he was? And why did he return to Europe in chains? Our guest is Stanley Payne, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, as we head into Columbus Day and think about this figure from history, give us some sense of his identity. I mean, here he's an Italian, but he's sailing for the Spanish and heading to the New World. Who was he?
He was quite clearly, as I believe, as he affirmed himself in documents that he signed, of Genoese origins and born in Genoa. Now, he lived nearly all his life away from there, and he may have, in fact, been taken from Genoa by his parents when young or not. We don't really know. But of his Genoese origins, I think there's no doubt, though there has developed in the past century an enormous controversy about the identity of Columbus, and there have been literally hundreds of publications in all kinds of languages trying to show that he was not Genoese. The main effort is made by the Catalans in Spain, who want him to be a Catalan or a Majorcan from the Balearic Islands, particularly the latter. Also the Portuguese. There's a literature on his supposed Portuguese identity. There are those who want Columbus to be Jewish or a Jewish convert, though that's a somewhat smaller literature. And there are all kinds of other things. But it is clear that from what he said, there's no reason to doubt his word, that he was a Genoese from the Republic of Genoa in northern Italy and began there at least, but we really don't know the details of his early life. We don't know at what age he left and what he was doing, for example, in his teenage years or in his 20s, if he was in Genoa or someplace else. In the 19th century, there was discovered a document in the archives in Genoa about an advanced artisan in the textile production business in Genoa named Domenico Colombo, who had 4 children, one of whom was named Cristoforo, in 1551. And many historians have thought, of course, this is a reference to the origins of Columbus himself in Genoa, but that is not absolutely clear because we can't really connect the dots. We simply know from what he said and from his frequent dealings with other Genoese that he was of Genoese origins. But we are not sure whether this really was the right family or not, and at what age he left Genoa and what he did, particularly for his first 30 years or so.
Well, the fact that all these nationalities and interest groups are clamoring for an affiliation with him certainly implies that there's still a good deal of admiration for Columbus, wherever he came from, and regardless of what he did.
He eventually became a famous man. He became a rather wealthy man from his voyages, much better off financially than he had ever been before that time. And then, of course, in subsequent generations, not as much during the years of his own life or immediately afterwards, but a little later on in the 16th century, was acclaimed. And, of course, at the time of the Quattrocentenary, in 1892. He was the great hero, the Columbian Exposition and so on. This had all changed in terms of political correctness perspective by the time of the quincentenary in 1992, and then he was denounced by some as a villain who brought great misery to the American Indians.
And probably everybody was right.
Yeah.
Probably everybody was right, yes.
And as you look at Columbus moving into a position where he's negotiating with royalty and trying to get his voyages underway and so on, what do you think his motivations are if you, you know, if you look at the writing he did and sort of trace his path? What made him tick? Was it desire for wealth, power, status?
The impulse to explore?
I think those two things together. He had been, as far as we can tell, for all his adult life, at sea one way or the other. And he was obsessed with the question of exploration and breaking through to Asia. Beyond that, he thought that it would present the West, as we can call Europe by this time, with a kind of geostrategic advantage against the Muslims and the expansion of the Ottoman Empire. So there was a geostrategic interest. But along with that, he thought that there was much wealth to be obtained by direct trade with Asia. And in the process, he wanted to establish a very good position for himself with status and with income. He probably would have liked to have eventually been given aristocratic rank in a society that in the 15th century was still very much a caste society. But he bargained very hard with the Spanish crown, and he set very strong terms that he would be governor general, that he would be admiral. That would really mean the commander in chief, because almirante in Castilian was an army term down to that time. And Columbus was the person who made the change, really, of applying the term of almirante or admiral to a sea command, though he thought that this would, of course, involve a base on land. So he bargained very hard, and he was also looking to advance his own interests in the process.
Weren't there already pretty reliable routes to the Far East, though, by land and by sea?
No, there were no reliable routes. Just a tiny number of people had been across Eurasia because it was such a gigantic journey and it took so long and was so difficult and so hazardous. And there was the question then of how you would get to the Far East by sea. The Portuguese were the leaders in maritime exploration in the 15th century. And as they sailed down the coast of Africa, past the equator, they were able to measure approximately correctly the circumference of the globe, and they knew that sailing west across the Atlantic, even if there was nothing between Asia and Europe, was a very long distance, more than 10,000 miles, because they knew approximately the measurement of degrees of latitude and longitude. Columbus was working on the basis of other kinds of calculations, which he'd gotten actually from books, which is curious. It was not empirical observation so much as his studies. He was a great bibliophile, something of a scholar, a great student, collected and read all kinds of things, and he was convinced that, in fact, Asia was not much more than 2,500 miles away. Mm-hmm. That is, it was approximately what we would call the Far West Atlantic. The Portuguese did not support him because they knew that it had to be much farther than that, and you couldn't sail 10,000 miles west. You had to go around Africa. So they were convinced correctly that the only way to get effectively to Asia was to continue their efforts to circumnavigate Africa, to get up around Africa and from there directly onto Asia, although they didn't complete that job until a few years later, until the very end of the 1490s.
And what would a map have looked like in one of Columbus's books? In other words, when he was trying to figure out where he was going, presumably it wasn't called the Atlantic yet? What would he have seen a picture of showing him what he would get if he sailed westward?
Well, basically the maps had to do with Europe, with North Africa, with the Middle East, extended out to the Canary Islands, Madeira, the Azores, and that was it. Then one just didn't know what was out there. There had been a variety of voyages and ships that went further out in the Atlantic. Centuries earlier, the Vikings had gotten to Iceland and Greenland, and other ships went into the North Atlantic because that was closer. It seems likely, although the evidence is very limited, the Portuguese sent ships sailing west, maybe as early as the middle of the 15th century, perhaps as early as 1450. And they would sail west with the trade winds, moving toward the south a bit, maybe for 2 weeks, we don't know. And 2 weeks beyond the sight of land in an area where no one had ever found any land got to be pretty scary.
Running out of food and water.
They would turn around after a while and come back, or some of them didn't come back at all. There were other efforts to try to do this on a limited scale. They hadn't worked. In fact, in 1487, right after he had negotiated with the Portuguese crown, the Portuguese sent a Dutch mariner who was in their employ to try more seriously the western route again. A chap named Van Halen, and Van Halen never came back, perished at sea. This further convinced the Portuguese that they were on the right course. They simply had to continue to pursue it until they had carried it out fully. And, of course, they did by 1500. They managed to get Vasco da Gama and the voyage to Asia, that is to India, in this case not to China, to India, and established the maritime trade route, which made the Portuguese elite quite wealthy for the next half century.
Now, the last time we talked to you, fleetingly about Columbus in the context of a discussion of the history of Spain, you referred to Columbus, I believe, as a mystic.
He became something of a religious mystic. It is not very clear, however, that he had been that all his life. One sees this coming on strongly with the second voyage, the end of 1493 on into the beginning of 1496. From that time on, the religious theme becomes more and more important. And after the third voyage, which for him personally ended in political disaster and his being sent back to Spain in chains, though he was largely absolved after he got back to Spain, he developed a kind of martyr complex. And certainly when he wrote his Book of Prophecies in 1501, there was a very strong sense of mysticism. He began to sign various of his documents with the Greco-Latin term Christo Ferens.
Bringing Christ.
Christ bearer. Yes. He was convinced now that the project was not just maritime, commercial, political, or geostrategic, but absolutely apocalyptic, because it would have the finality of bringing all parts of the human race together. They could be evangelized. This was what was necessary to bring about the second coming. He thought that all of this would take some time. And the indication was that, in fact, the world would last not just 5 or 10 years. It would last a little while longer, maybe 150 years. But this project during that time would be carried out completely, and then would come the apocalypse, the end of the world, and the second coming of Christ. And he was convinced by that time, in the later years of his life, that he had a kind of divine calling, a real religious mission to pursue this further and help bring it all about.
Can you talk about his negotiations with Ferdinand and Isabella and what the state of the Spanish court was at that point that led them to kind of strike up a deal with Columbus? The Portuguese had turned him away, so why did the Spanish go for it?
He had begun the negotiations in Spain something like 5 years earlier, around 1487. And some of the leaders of the Spanish church, who were well-educated, thought this was a very interesting idea. And a commission was named. I've forgotten the site. A commission of experts was set up to evaluate the project. And their evaluation was negative, that he was making certain errors, as indeed he was, certain empirical errors, and this was not going to work to get to Asia directly across the Atlantic. At that time, the Spanish crown had invested literally all of its energies, every bit of energy and money it had, in pressing home the final campaign against the Emirate of Granada in the eastern, southeastern corner of the peninsula, the last surviving Muslim state in Spain, to finish off Granada and completely unify the peninsula, bring the peninsula under Christian rule, and finalize the reconquest of native Spanish territory. This took an enormous amount of money. It was difficult because Granada, the mountainous area, it had to be gnawed away and sliced off one section at a time, 1 year at a time, every year for 10 years. It was not until 1491 that finally the Castilian forces were able to close in on the city and lay siege to the city of Granada itself. So one of the problems here, not merely did the commission of experts not give Columbus an endorsement, but also there simply was no money. All the money was going into the war. This came to an end, however, at the close of January 1492, Columbus was back again at that time. In fact, most of those 5 years, spent nearly all that time in Spain, and this was the time probably in which he really learned Spanish well. His Portuguese was excellent. He developed very good Spanish, learned to speak Spanish with absolute fluency, though Las Casas, the famous friar, said that although he spoke Spanish very well and with very little accent, it seemed to Las Casas as though somehow this was not his native language. As indeed it was not. I mean, presumably De Genoese dialect was his native language. But even then, the experts didn't support him, though some figures in the church did. And so the crown coming off this great victory was actually in pretty dire financial straits. There was a big debt. So again, no decision to support Columbus, although it obviously intrigued the rulers, Fernando and Isabel. So he left. And in fact, in the late spring of 1492, he was on his way to France, traveling by land across Spain to France to try the French crown. He'd been turned down by the Portuguese. He'd been turned down repeatedly by the Spanish. Now he was on his way to France when a messenger caught up with him in central Spain and said, "Come back. The monarchy has changed its mind. You're going to get support." And he did get support. It was provided particularly by various pieces of money and credit, not just money, but credit gotten together by the head of the royal household of Fernando, the king of Aragon, Luis de Santángel, who was a converso of a Jewish family and was really the treasurer of Aragon. And it wasn't so much that he found all the money, but the port city of Palos on the southwestern Atlantic coast, which would be a good jumping-off point, had a debt to the crown. It was arranged that it cancel its debt to the crown by providing two ships and men and supplies. So by hook or crook, they finally put this together in the late summer of 1492.
And we're going to follow Columbus across the Atlantic when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Stanley Payne, who is filling us in about the life and trials of Christopher Columbus. And we have come to that magical year of 1492, where Columbus, with support from the Spanish crown, is sailing west toward what he has convinced everybody is going to be Asia. You mentioned, Stanley, that previous efforts had gone out a week or 2 weeks and either failed, disappeared, or turned around and come back. Columbus keeps on going, though, much more than 2 weeks. What makes him persist?
He was absolutely convinced that he was right, and he knew that in order to prove it, they had to take risks and simply had to keep going after he was about 1 month into the main prong of the voyage from the Canary Islands. He was faced with a potential mutiny, which he was able to put down. A few days later, there was a second potential mutiny on the 10th of October. And apparently what he told his crewmen was that he was sure, since they'd now traveled about 3,000 miles, they had to be very close, and he asked their patience for just a few days more. He'd never made it clear how many days, whether it was 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, but just a little more time, and they said, "All right, we'll keep going, but just for a few more days." And then, less than 48 hours later, after putting down the second would-be mutiny on the 10th of October, 2 a.m. on the 12th of October, on a moonlit night, a very light-colored beach on an island was observed by the lookout up in the mast. Land was sighted, it was announced, and so they had found land across the ocean.
We still don't know which land, though, exactly.
Well, one of the Bahamas. It's not... Well, they think they know which one of the Bahamas, but this may not be entirely certain. He had gotten to the Bahamas, and then after spending some time there, moved down to Santo Domingo, which is now the island of Haiti, and the Dominican Republic, which became then the main base of Spanish operations for the next 15, 20 years.
And what was in the three ships that he took along? You know, when he was planning a trip like that, where you don't know where you're going exactly, what do you take?
Well, you simply take all the supplies you can. The catch was he could not take very much because these are very small little wooden ships. For the quincentenary in Palos, the point of departure on the southwestern Atlantic coast, the Spanish authorities set up a kind of theme park and provided replicas of the original ships. Well, you could now go out onto these things, the two very small caravels, that is, fast boats for the high seas, the Niña and the Pinta.
75 feet long, something like that?
Oh, no. The caravels are smaller than that. Well, maybe a bit about that long, but they were very narrow boats. And the Santa Maria, which was a NAO, an NAO, that is a commercial or cargo boat, was bigger. But even the Santa Maria was hardly 60 feet long. And its hold had a depth of about 9-10 feet, whereas the Niña and the Pinta were distinctly smaller yet as different kinds of ships. So the idea of crossing the Atlantic in these little wooden vessels is rather terrifying. And all they carried basically was all the supplies they possibly could.
He records in his diary this phenomenal description of his reception, and it seems to ring true or resonate through similar accounts by later explorers in other parts of the world. He says of the inhabitants, "They brought us parrots and balls of cotton and spears and many other things, which they exchanged for the glass beads and hawks' bells. They willingly traded everything they owned. They were well built, with good bodies and handsome features. They do not bear arms and do not know them, for I showed them a sword. They took it by the edge and cut themselves out of ignorance. They have no iron. Their spears are made of cane. They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want." Right on day one, there's a somber note struck.
Yes, from the very beginning, although they made a good impression on Columbus. He saw that these were people who probably could be very easily dominated. Now, remember his perspective. His perspective still is, and was down to the time that he died, nearly 15 years later in 1506, that these are islands off the coast of East Asia. So you just have to keep going until you arrive to the territory of the Great Khan, as they called the Chinese emperor. But these apparently would be other islands who were not under the patrimony of anyone, so one could set up colonies or trading posts, as the Portuguese did on these islands. So this became the goal for commercial expansion, commercial exploitation, and for establishing imperial domain from the very beginning, although he was convinced that it still had to do only with the offshore regions of Asia.
And he called the area the West Indies at this
point? This is how they get to be the Indies and how the inhabitants get to be Indians, because presumably they are inhabitants of the Indies. And this is actually conceived as the easternmost part of the Indies. But therefore, Indios, they call them. Indios in Spanish, the inhabitants of the Indies.
And how does he reconcile these two notions that he's already floated from the beginning, Christianizing on one hand and enslaving on the other?
There's a good deal of cognitive dissonance here. And the Queen of Castile, Isabel, was very clear after that time that the Indians could not be enslaved unless they were engaged in warfare against the Spanish. They had to be then. In the second voyage, missionaries were sent. There was no priest on the first voyage. So missionary activity was not a goal of the first voyage. It became a major goal in the second voyage, and it was a goal established particularly by leadership back in Spain. Though from that point on, Columbus himself became more and more convinced of the transcendent and spiritual significance of what he was doing. This, however, did not diminish other aspects of his multi-ambitious project, which was to do well by himself, to build a significant status and estate for himself, and, of course, to establish a kind of new imperial domain. So we have a cognitive dissonance. The different thing about this, however, was that the Spanish, particularly some of the church, but also the government leaders, the monarchy back in Spain, became more and more worried about this, This is territory inhabited by other people who have a kind of domain over it. They have never done anything bad to the Spanish the way the Muslims have. They're not really enemies. So therefore, is it legal to go in and take their country over? It was clear to the Spanish authorities that you could not simply enslave them. That was not right. And so you have the debate going on in Spain, which continued all the way down to the 1550s for over half a century. What legal basis was there for doing this? It was finally decided there was a certain circumscribed legal basis and that the Indians could be dominated in certain ways, though not enslaved, and their rights and a good deal of the territory had to be respected to them as much as possible. These were decisions eventually made by the monarchy and its advisors back in Spain. These decisions, however, were not very much observed by the followers of Columbus and the voyages that came after, the kinds of people who within a few more years would simply be known as conquistadores, as conquerors of the new lands of the Indies. So there was a, despite the efforts of the Spanish authorities to be consistent and to be responsible, the moral and cognitive dissonance on the ground in the Caribbean was profound, and they didn't abide by these rules. Now, on his third voyage, when a Spanish inspection mission was sent out under a high official, decided that what Columbus was doing was too high-handed. He was not obeying the guidelines set down by the monarchy. He had disobeyed orders, and he was not a good politician and not a very good administrator. And that's why at the end of the third voyage, when he came back in 1500, he was sent home in chains. But this encouraged, as I mentioned earlier, a kind of martyr complex and heightened the sense that he was involved in a really transcendent and spiritual and apocalyptic enterprise, which was of broader importance than what, if anything, he'd conceived back in 1492.
Well, back at the end of the first voyage, so he's arrived. What does he decide to take back with him on those three ships, and how long to stay, and what kind of case to make to the Spanish monarchy that would lead to a second voyage?
Well, he could not bring very much in the way of trading goods, just a little. So they did trade, as was indicated in the excerpt that was just read. There was some trading, looking for gold. Couldn't find any gold in the Bahamas, did find some gold on Santo Domingo. And so what he's going to tell the monarchy when he gets back to Spain is that he has found the way across the ocean. He has found the outskirts to the Andes, and he's found a new territory there which does not belong to the Great Khan, even though it must be very close to China. And this is territory, therefore, on which Spanish dominion can be established, really Castilian dominion by the crown of the Kingdom of Castile, which will be a very good commercial entrepot from which one can make a good deal of money in trade and build up a strong geostrategic situation, and, of course, also from which it's possible to extend the borders of Christendom and to preach the gospel.
Is everybody in Spain, including Columbus, still assuming that this is Asia, some outlying islands and even some mainlands of Asia?
That's probably a fair assumption, that most people in Spain at first accepted his definition of the situation. The Portuguese were alarmed, and yet they knew that what Columbus had discovered was probably not the main part of Asia. But the Portuguese were alarmed. They were encountering complications of their own, and it would be several years before they could really make the big push to get all the way around. They'd gotten down to the tip of Africa, but they had not gotten beyond. They finally made the big push in the very last years of the decade. So some of the best-informed people were skeptical that Columbus had really had found anything close to the main part of Asia. But there were only very few people who were that well informed.
So by now, what has, by the time of his third voyage, where all has Columbus touched?
By the third voyage, he'd gotten about as far as he was going to get. He had visited various islands. He had seen Jamaica. He had visited Cuba. He had also gone across to the American mainland to what was apparently Yucatan in eastern Mexico. And he was convinced that Yucatan was simply another very big island like Santo Domingo or Cuba, which was, again, on the road very close to getting to East Asia. So nothing shook his conviction about this all the way down to the end. It wasn't until later, on other voyages, under the Spanish flag. For example, some led by his fellow Genoese explorer and entrepreneur Amerigo Vespucci had gone down the coast of South America. And Vespucci went so far down the coast of South America, he said, well, this is obviously not an island. This is some kind of continent. There's some kind of continent between Europe and Asia. And we simply need to explore this more, and reported that. Then when the German cartographer was putting together his map of most of the world, about 1510, he very vaguely indicated there was some continental mass over there in the West Atlantic. And since this had been explored to the south along the landmass by Amerigo Vespucci, he invented a kind of Latinized term for it after the second Genoese and called it America.
Columbus must have had to have a very large ego, don't you think?
He had a large ego. He was an enormously determined person. He had great self-confidence. And he was, of course, a courageous man who was willing to put not merely his money, but himself where his mouth was, and run the risk of simply sailing to extinction. But he had absolute determination. Yes, he did have great determination and a great deal of personal and physical courage.
How did his nautical skills set him apart from the competitors or those to follow?
He was a good sailor. He had made this basic mistake in calculation as to the extent of the circumference of the world. But he was a good sailor as far as the techniques of sailing were concerned. He had been on ships probably ever since he was an older teenager. He understood sailing. He'd been with the Portuguese a good deal. He had been married to a Portuguese aristocratic woman. How he ever made the marriage around 1480, we don't know because he was obviously not an aristocrat, but he married up. She very soon died, but left him with a son who became his heir, Diego, who became, in fact, the governor of Santo Domingo later on, right after Columbus died around 1508, 1510. But he simply had this kind of determination that carried him forward because he was convinced he was a visionary. He was not originally a religious mystic. He became something of a religious mystic, but he had always been a visionary. And he was determined that this was going to work and would amount to something. And he had also personal ambition. It all went together. It's very typical, of course, of the conquistadores who came afterwards from Castile. There was a great deal of personal ambition, which is why he bargained so hard. And so he was a real pusher. And obviously not any kind of normal personality. We know from the descriptions that he was a rather taller than average, sturdy man, obviously had stood lots and lots of long voyages, very resistant. He'd been ruddy and red-haired as a youth, but his hair turned white very early. Why that happened, one doesn't know. It's perhaps just a genetic thing. But all through his 30s, and by the time of the voyage to America, when he was at least 41, maybe 46, he had completely white hair, but a great deal also of physical vigor, as well as this extraordinary self-confidence.
But the pictures we have of him are fake, like portraits and so
on.
There's
yes,
no actual picture of Columbus.
There is no reliable, even less than of Shakespeare. At least we may have one or two portraits of Shakespeare, may or may not. We have no portrait of Columbus at all.
And the rules that he broke then on his third voyage, tell us about that.
In Santo Domingo, he was given guidelines about how to handle relations with the Indians, particularly, and also about how the administration of commerce would be set up, and he didn't follow these. He was not maybe the best administrator. He didn't have a great deal of strictly administrative talent. And so some of the Spanish said that he had not treated them fairly, that he had played favorites. The facts on this are very murky. And then he hadn't followed the guidelines in dealing with the Indians. So when the inspector came out, Bobadilla said that Columbus was guilty of direct disobedience of royal orders. And that's when he clapped him in chains and sent him back that way.
But had he been cruel then to the Indians?
You might say because the Spanish then had the business, they wanted to make money out of the enterprise. There was some gold on Santo Domingo, not a lot. They wanted to get gold from the Indians, and they had to make the Indians work. Well, the way to make the Indians work more and more was to sort of enslave them. This was very hard on them, especially because they had no resistance to European diseases. And what really destroyed the Indians in a sizable part of the Caribbean, and then later on the mainland as well, was not the cruelty of the Spanish, though sometimes the Spanish were indeed quite cruel and exploitative of them in a very direct way, but simply the microbes. They couldn't withstand smallpox and other kinds of epidemic diseases to which the Europeans were at least semi-immune, and they perished in vast numbers, so that after 20 years, on Santo Domingo, there were hardly any real Indians left. There was a kind of mestizo society, see, of the children of the Spanish with Indian women. So there were descendants of the Indians, but on Santo Domingo, the regular Indian society had almost become extinct. This happened on a fair number of other Caribbean islands as well. On the American mainland, there were many more Indians. So during the course of the 16th century, the population of Mexico plummeted. This enabled Mexico, of course, to become more of a mestizo, mixed-race society, because there were more Spaniards proportionate to Indians by 1550 or 1600 than could possibly have been the case had all the Indians survived. But the surviving Indians in Mexico, which had a large population, were only a fraction of the original population by the end of the 16th century. And this was the way everywhere the Europeans went. Even if they didn't want to mistreat the Indians, they brought their microbes with them.
There was one theory, I guess it's gaining some currency, that the Indians returned the favor, albeit unwittingly, by sending syphilis back to Europe.
Yes. Columbus reported the situation of the Indians as being something like a paradise, the state of nature. Well, one of the serpents in paradise was the fact that the Indians were syphilitic, and some of Columbus's crewmen got that. Now, Pinzon, the experienced naval commander who was the commander of one of the two caravels, died within a month after getting back to Spain. And it is said, although I'm not sure we can 100% verify this, that he was the first fatality of syphilis among Europeans. But within just a year or two, this is spreading around Italy and France. It's, you know, despite all of the restrictions in that society, it's really impressive how promiscuous it was at the same time, because syphilis is spreading all around southwestern Europe in just a matter of a few years, certainly by the end of the decade.
We'll look more at the final years of Columbus's life and his legacy when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. It is now 17 years since I came to serve these princes with the Enterprise of the Indies. They made me pass 8 of them in discussion, and at the end rejected it as a thing of jest. Nevertheless, I persisted therein. Over there I have placed under their sovereignty more land than there is in Africa and Europe, and more than 1,700 islands. In 7 years, I, by the divine will, made that conquest. At a time when I was entitled to expect rewards in retirement, I was incontinently arrested and sent home loaded with chains. The accusation was brought out of malice on the basis of charges made by civilians who had revolted and wished to take possession on the land. I beg your graces, with the zeal of faithful Christians in whom their highnesses have confidence, to read all my papers and to consider how I, who came from so far to serve these princes, now at the end of my days have been despoiled of my honor and my property without cause, wherein is neither justice nor mercy. That's Christopher Columbus writing in October 1500. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland and our guest Stanley Payne. We're talking about Christopher Columbus. It's a rather self-pitying letter.
Well, when he wrote that letter, of course, he just got back to Spain. The chains were taken off, and he was justifying himself. He was, by that time, approximately 50 years of age. He may have been nearly 55. And, of course, at the end of the 15th century, this was a considerable age. He had had white hair for something like 20 years, and he now saw himself as an old man who had accomplished great things. He believed he had achieved what he had set out to achieve. Nothing would ever shake his confidence about that. And he believed that he was entitled to more recognition than he got. He would like to have received better status, even though he had gained income. And he was not a poor man now. He had a certain financial status. He believed that he deserved more recognition and a kind of political and social status, which he had not obtained. And he then produced within the next year the Book of Prophecies, which is a collection really of all kinds of accounts of prophecies, predictions about the end of the world and the apocalypse. And his thinking now is oriented more and more in that direction in his last years. After two more years, he was sent out on his fourth and final voyage in 1502. And this was just as unsuccessful as the third voyage had been. He ended up completely stranded on the south shore of the island of Jamaica for 8 months until they finally came over from Santo Domingo to rescue him. And during that time, his health collapsed. He probably had already been suffering from arthritis rather severely, and this was one of the ideas which convinced him that he didn't have too much farther to go. And on the fourth and final voyage, the arthritis became very severe, and apparently he could barely walk. So that from that time on, from about 1503, the last 3 years of his life, he had very poor health, and he suffered from other kinds of maladies as well. He faced another mutiny while stranded on the south shore of Jamaica.
Why was he stranded? What made him stranded? The
ships could no longer continue. They had been wrecked in the storm, and he ran them aground. He said, the best thing to do is just run them aground, and we'll beach them, and we can live off of them and send smaller boats over to Santo Domingo to be rescued, and this will provide a shelter. And hopefully it will only be, say, a month or so until we can get something arranged. Well, it took the better part of a year. So they lived in these three beached ships, and he had to face another mutiny there. There was even a fight, but his younger brother organized his partisans effectively and in a very brief skirmish defeated the mutineers, and they simply had to hold on for those 8 months until they were rescued, and soon afterward he went back to Spain, and that was the end of the voyages, the two more years in Spain. He was in good financial situation, but still somewhat embittered because he believed he had not achieved the recognition and the social and political status that he merited, even though he found himself now in a rather good financial position.
When did the next expedition by someone other than Columbus?
Well, there were other expeditions even during his time to Santo Domingo and then moving on to Cuba. Cuba became the next major base after Santo Domingo and the other islands. So they had already begun in the 1490s. They were going out by 1505. They were going out every year, sometimes maybe several a year. The number of Spaniards involved was not very much, but it was a fairly constant enterprise. We don't have much commitment of manpower and only limited commitment of money, but it was something that was going on regularly now and was carried out under a royal charter, yes, but to a remarkable degree on a freelance basis by Spanish merchants and adventurers and even some aristocrats. So the crown gave them the authority, gave them a kind of framework of sovereignty, but these expeditions more and more began to do it on their own. It did control the movement of the fleets and insisted on, after 1503, centralizing all the trading and the commerce, the precious metals brought back through Seville. It was at that time possible, at the beginning of the 16th century, to bring these small ocean-going vessels all the way up the Guadalquivir River, which is one of the largest rivers in Spain, to the city of Seville. Now, later on, that couldn't be done because the river silted up and they simply didn't have the dredging equipment in the 17th century to open up the channel. But in the 16th century, it was all centralized through Seville. So the crown did not so much lose control of the fleets and the commerce and the precious metal. It did in part, but it lost control to a degree of what was going on the land, and hence the business of sending out inspectors more and more to try to check up. Columbus was not the only Spanish administrator and commander in the Americas who was sent back in chains. The crown made an effort to keep it under control, but it could not keep it entirely under control.
And what difference then do you think, okay, so we have Columbus Day where we're supposed to think about Columbus. What difference do you think he made? In other words, had Columbus not made those voyages and the three ships, would just some other person have done pretty much the same thing pretty soon after?
Probably. No one was going to do it in the 15th century, but someone would have done it during the 16th century, doubtless. It took a visionary and very vigorous personality to do that sort of thing. It wouldn't have been done again for who knows how long. Probably sometime later on in the 16th century, it would have happened. But Columbus was the person who made it happen, and he made it happen when it did because of his conviction and determination, partly because of his eloquence and arguments, He was a good writer, probably. He could talk pretty well, too. And, of course, the importance of all of this was enormous. And since he was the leader who did make it happen at that point, he eventually, not during his lifetime, but later on, has gotten enormous attention and credit, and with every reason, because he did it and no one else had.
Did he really spark a kind of a land rush mentality among other European nations, though? I mean, Spain has staked out the Caribbean pretty well within just a couple of years, a few voyages. But are other European countries now starting to speculate, oh, there must be something north, there must be something farther south that we can get?
A little. But the fact is only a little. Because in these first years, although the Spanish and the crown made some money out of these things, it was not an enormous bonanza. And sailing west was a novel enterprise. In the North European countries, they didn't really understand all of the maritime problems involved. So it didn't start a big rush. There was some emulation, various attempts to do the same sort of thing, France and England, Flanders, but only a limited number of such attempts because it was complicated, it was expensive, it required expert knowledge.
And no guarantees.
And there were no guarantees. And the Portuguese had been in this business a long time. And the Portuguese only began to make money after 1500. And then they made money out of a very, very difficult enterprise of going all the way, enormous voyages that could take an entire year at sea to get to India and then come back again. They were making a lot of money, yes, but who else wanted to make the sacrifices to make these kinds of voyages to India? Well, at first, in the first half of the 16th century, nobody. So the Portuguese had a semi-monopoly just naturally. Now, with each passing generation, more experience and more expertise built up in other countries, in France, in England, in the Low Countries particularly, so that by the middle of the 16th century there was more activity, and particularly in the later 16th century. But the French did not make much of an effort to explore or colonize just a little bit, and the English only got going really in the 1590s with Roanoke.
Kind of ironic, isn't it, if you think about the fact that Columbus wouldn't have accomplished what he did if he had been right? In other words, that at the basis of his confidence and determination was erroneous calculation of the circumference of the earth?
Exactly, exactly. He was convinced of his mission, but he stumbled onto the islands because he had no notion really that the islands were there, although they were where he wanted to get to. So the calculation was right that he would find land after about 3,000 miles. It was just a totally different kind of land from what he anticipated. And this is the role of sublime error in human destiny, one might say.
So often the case, isn't it? When did the Spanish finally strike gold in any really lucrative sense? And where did Columbus's fortune come from if it didn't come from gold?
Well, they did find a certain amount of gold and forced the Indians to mine a little gold in Santo Domingo. So there was precious metal coming back. There was gold, and there were other items of trade, so that there was an income. And Columbus's estate, which by 1500 had really come to exist, built on that. He was able to maintain very well his sort of common-law Spanish wife, who was a middle-class orphan, not of a bad family, but a middle-class orphan, a woman whom he apparently would not have married, though he was attached to her, because she didn't have status. She wasn't like his Portuguese wife, who'd been an aristocrat. And he wanted to make, if he was going to marry again, he wanted to make a good marriage. And then later on, by 1500, he decided he was simply too old, didn't worry about that. But he never married Beatrice. However, he left her well provided for. Even as early as the 1490s, she was the mother of his second son, Hernando, who became a scholar and bibliophile, started what became known as the Biblioteca Colombina, the Colombian Library in Seville, and wrote the first biography of his father, needless to say, very laudatory, though it was not published for generations and generations. So money was made. And that's why they kept going, because they were making money. They weren't making big killings for the most part. The money really started to pour in with the conquest of Mexico after 1517, and then Peru. And then from that time on, they could organize not so much gold mines, but the silver mines. Mm-hmm. So what was produced in enormous quantities were vast amounts of silver, such as no one in Europe had ever seen at that time, in Mexico and particularly in Peru and Bolivia. And that were really going strong by the middle decades of the 16th century. And that was the really big money. And that continued for a long time. The silver mines continued to work on through, later on somewhat lesser volume, they continued to work on into the 18th century, so that there was a lot of money. But the big money only started to flow in after 1517, that is 11 years after Columbus died.
How did it affect the European economy, all this wealth coming in?
Well, it was not productive wealth. It was simply a financial lubricant. But the financial lubricant increased the money supply, so it served as a kind of stimulus for trade and therefore as a stimulus for production. The problem was that as the big money began to come into Spain in the 16th century, it inevitably set off a kind of inflation because the Spanish economy in the 16th century, though not really poor by 16th century standards, was no more than a middling economy. It was not highly productive. And in fact, the enormous increase in taxes, particularly by the crown, to finance the wars had such a negative effect on the economy that for that and a variety of other reasons that we don't have time to go into, Spanish economy began to go into decline by the end of the century. And the silver particularly simply flowed out of the country for imports and to pay the royal debts and didn't really end up benefiting the Spanish economy, just as all the money the Portuguese made on the trade with India, the original spice trade, which was a lot of money between about 1500 and 1550, did not benefit the Portuguese economy. It was spent on luxury goods, spent by the crown, spent for conspicuous consumption, spent to finance war and other activities, did not stimulate the economy, partly because the economy at home was weak and didn't have the entrepreneurial input to enable it to be stimulated very well.
Final verdict on Columbus, looking at him both in terms of the way we see his, you know, courage and adventurousness, but also in terms of Native American history. Final verdict on him?
Well, there is the good and the bad. Columbus was a great hero. The impact on a lot of the American Indians was absolutely disastrous, and hence all the criticism in 1992. There's no question that he disobeyed the guidelines, as the Spanish did generally, and the terms were weaseled to create a very exploitative society and economy, even though the crown preserved part of the Indian population in Mexico and in Peru, completely apart and autonomous from Spanish colonial society. Still, the impact was very destructive, though it created also a new society and a new culture. The origins of many civilizations lie in conquest. Think of William the Conqueror and the origins of the English language. Not a nice thing to be an Anglo-Saxon around 1070.
Give us 500 years or so. Things might turn up a little bit better. It's certainly been a fascinating hour with you and Columbus, Stanley Payne. Always a pleasure. And celebrate or observe or just think about Columbus Day when October 12th comes. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. Hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, we'll look into the future and speculate with geopolitical analyst Gwynne Dyer, who is the author of the recent book Climate Wars. We'll find out what his speculations are and how they might be forestalled here on Wisconsin Public Radio.